We've got the gear to investigate, she added, motioning towards the Numa boat. Right, Dirk agreed. We need to look at the seabed off Gill Island. The answer has to lie there. Can you stay and conduct a survey? Trevor asked with a hopeful tone. Dirk looked at Summer. I received a call from the Seattle office. They need the boat back by the end of the week for some work in Puget Sound. We can stay two more days, then we'll have to hit the road. That will allow us time to examine a good chunk of territory off Gill Island, Summer said. Let's plan for an early start tomorrow. Will you be able to join us, Trevor? It was her turn to give a hopeful look. I wouldn't miss it, he replied happily. As they were leaving the dock together, the brown Jeep with a rental agency sticker on its bumper cruised slowly along the adjacent roadway. The driver stopped briefly at a clearing which gave an unobstructed view of the municipal dock and harbor. Behind the wheel, Clay Zack gazed out the windshield, studying the two boats at the end of the dock tied up one behind the other. He nodded to himself, then continued driving slowly down the road. Chapter 36 When Trevor arrived at the dock around 7 the next morning, Dirk and Summer were already laying out their sonar equipment on the stern deck. He gave Summer a quick peck while Dirk was occupied coiling a tow cable, then he pulled a small cooler onto the boat. "Hope everyone can stomach some fresh smoked salmon for lunch," he said. "I'd say that's a vast improvement over Dirk's stockpile of peanut butter and dill pickles," Summer replied. "Never have to worry about it going bad," Dirk defended. He walked into the wheelhouse and started the boat's motor, then returned to the stern deck. "I'll need to refuel before we head out," he announced. "There's a fuel dock just around the bend," Trevor replied. "It's a little cheaper than the gas at the city marina." He thought for a moment. "I'm a little low myself. Why don't you follow me over and we can drop my boat on the way out the channel?" Dirk nodded in agreement, and Trevor hopped onto the deck and strolled down to his boat moored just behind the Numa vessel. He unlocked the door to the wheelhouse, then fired up the inboard diesel, listening to its deep, throaty idle. Checking his fuel gauge, he noted a pair of sunglasses on the dashboard that Summer had left behind. Looking up, he saw her untying the dock lines to the Numa boat. Grabbing the glasses, he hopped off the boat and jogged down the dock. "Some protection for those pretty gray eyes?" he asked. Summer tossed the bowline aboard, then looked up to see Trevor standing with her sunglasses in an outstretched hand. She gazed skyward for a moment, taking in a thick layer of rain clouds overhead, before locking eyes with him. "A tad overkill for today, but thanks for proving you're not a thief." She reached over and grabbed the sunglasses as a sharp crack suddenly erupted behind them. The report was followed by a thunderous blast that flung them to the dock, a shower of splinters tearing over their heads. Trevor fell forward and onto Summer, protecting her from the debris as several small chunks of wood and fiberglass struck him in the back. A simple 5-minute timed safety fuse, attached to 4 cartridges of nitroglycerin dynamite and wired to the ignition switch of Trevor's boat, had ignited the inferno. The blast nearly ripped the entire stern section off the government boat while flattening most of the wheelhouse. The stern quickly sank from sight while the mangled bow clung stubbornly to the surface, dangling at a grotesque angle by the attached dock line. Dirk was standing in the cabin of his own vessel when the blast struck and was unscathed by any flying debris. He immediately scrambled onto the dock and found Summer being helped to her feet by Trevor. Like Dirk, she was unhurt by the blast. Trevor was less fortunate. His back was soaked with blood from a large splinter embedded in his shoulder, and he limped from a timber that had slammed into his leg. He ignored the injuries and hobbled over to the smoldering remains of his boat. Summer and Dirk checked each other to ensure they were uninjured. Then Dirk jumped back aboard and grabbed a fire extinguisher, dousing several smoldering piles of debris that threatened to start a larger fire. Summer found a towel and hurried over to Trevor, who was compressing the cut on his shoulder as he stared blankly at the destroyed ruins of his boat. As a police siren wailed its imminent approach, Trevor turned and gazed at Summer with a look of hurt and anger. "It has to be Terra Green," he muttered quietly. "I wonder if they killed my brother, too." At a harborside coffee shop 2 miles away, Clay's axe stared out the window, admiring the plume of smoke and flame that rose above the water in the distance. Finishing an espresso in Danish, he left a large tip on the table, then walked to his brown rented Jeep parked up the street. "Smoke on the water," he muttered aloud, humming the deep purple rock tune before climbing into the car. Without the least concern, he drove to the airport outside of town, where Mitchell Goyette's private jet waited for him on the tarmac. Chapter 37. The business jet circled the airfield once, waiting for a small plane to take off and clear the field before the control tower gave approval to land. Painted in the same shade of turquoise as its fellow sea vessels, the Numa Hawker 750 touched down lightly on the runway. The small jet taxied to a red brick building before pulling to a halt alongside a much larger Gulfstream G650. The fuselage door opened and Pitt quickly stepped out, slipping on a jacket to ward off a brisk chill in the air. He walked into the terminal building where he was greeted by a rotund man standing behind a counter. "Welcome to Elliott Lake. It's not often we have two jets in on the same day," he said in a friendly, rural voice. "A little short for the carriers?" Pitt asked. "Our runway is only 4,500 feet, but we hope to expand it next year. Can I fix you up with a rental car?" Pitt nodded and soon left the terminal with a set of keys to a blue Ford SUV. Spreading a map on the hood of the car, he studied his new surroundings. Elliott Lake was a small town near the northeast shores of Lake Huron. Situated some 275 miles due north of Detroit, the town lay in the Algoma district of Ontario Province. Surrounded by Canadian wilderness, the landscape was a lush mix of rugged mountains, winding rivers, and deep lakes. Pitt found the airport on his map, carved out of the dense forest a few miles south of the town. He traced a lone highway that traveled south through the mountains, culminating on the shores of Lake Huron and the Trans-Canada Highway. About 15 miles to the west was Pitt's destination, an old logging and mining town called Blind River. The drive was scenic, the road winding past several mountain lakes and a surging river that dropped over a steep waterfall. The terrain flattened as he reached the shores of Lake Huron and the town of Blind River. He drove slowly through the small hamlet, admiring the quaint wood homes, which were mostly built in the 1930s. Pitt continued past the city limits until spotting a large steel warehouse adjacent to a field littered with high mounds of rock and ore. A large maple leaf flag flew above a weathered sign that read Ontario Miners Co-op and Repository. Pitt turned in and parked near the entrance as a broad-shouldered man in a brown suit walked down the steps and climbed into a late-model white sedan. Pitt noticed the man stare at him through a pair of dark sunglasses as he climbed out of his own rental car and entered the building. The dusty interior resembled a mining museum. Rusty ore carts and pickaxes jammed the corners alongside high shelves that overflowed with mining journals and old photographs. Behind a long wooden counter sat a massive antique banker's safe that Pitt guessed held the more valuable mineral samples. Seated behind the counter was an older man who appeared almost as dusty as the room's interior. He had a bulb-shaped head, and his gray hair, eyes, and mustache matched the faded flannel shirt he wore beneath a pair of striped suspenders. He peered at Pitt through a pair of Ben Franklin glasses perched low on his nose. "Good morning," Pitt said, introducing himself. Gazing up at a polished tin container that resembled a large liquor flask, he remarked, "Beautiful old oil catcher you have there." The old man's eyes lit up as he realized Pitt wasn't a lost tourist looking for directions. "Yep, used to refill the early miners' oil lamps. Came from the nearby Bruce Mines. My grandpappy worked the copper mines there till they shut down in 1921, he said in a wheezy voice. "A lot of copper in these hills?" Pitt asked. "Not enough to last long. Most of the copper and gold mines shut down decades ago. Attracted a lot of dirt diggers in their day, but not too many folks got rich from it," he replied, shaking his head. Looking Pitt in the eye, he asked, "What can I do for you today?" "I'd like to know about your stock of ruthenium." "Ruthenium?" he asked, looking at Pitt queerly. "You with that big fella that was just in here?" "No," Pitt replied. He recalled the odd behavior of the man in the brown suit and tried to shake off a nagging sense of familiarity. That's peculiar, the man said, eyeing Pitt with suspicion. That other fellow was from the Natural Resources Ministry in Ottawa. Here checking our supply and sources of ruthenium. Odd that it was the only mineral he was interested in, and you come walking in asking about the same thing. Did he tell you his name? John Booth, I believe he said. A bit of an odd bird, I thought. Now, what's your interest, Mr. Pitt? Pitt generally explained Lisa Lane's research at George Washington University and ruthenium's role in her scientific work. He neglected to disclose the magnitude of her recent discovery or the recent explosion at the lab. Yes, I recall sending a sample to that lab a week or two ago. We don't get too many requests for ruthenium, just a few public research labs and the occasional high-tech company. With the price going so crazy, not too many folks can afford to dabble with it anymore. Of course, that price spike has made us a nice profit when we do get an order, he smiled with a wink. I just wish we had a source to replenish our inventory. You don't have an ongoing supplier? Oh, heavens, no, not in years. I reckon my stock will be depleted before long. We used to get some from a platinum mine in eastern Ontario, but the ore they're pulling out now isn't showing any meaningful content. No, as I was telling Mr. Booth, most of our ruthenium stocks came from the Inuit. They mined it up north? Pitt asked. Apparently so. I pulled the acquisition records for Mr. Booth, he said, pointing to an ancient leather-bound journal sitting at the other end of the counter. The stuff was acquired over 100 years ago. There's a detailed accounting in the logbook. The Inuit referred to it as the Black Kabluna, or some such. We always called it the Adelaide sample, as the Inuit were from a camp on the Adelaide Peninsula in the Arctic. So that's the extent of the Canadian supply of ruthenium? As far as I know. But nobody knows if there's more to the Inuit source. It all surfaced so long ago. The story was that the Inuit were afraid to return to the island where they obtained it because of a dark curse, something about bad spirits and the source being tainted by death and insanity, or similar mumbo-jumbo. A tall tale of the North, I guess. I've found that local legends often have some basis in fact, Pitt replied. Do you mind if I take a look at the journal? Not at all. The old geologist ambled down to the end of the counter and returned with the book, flipping through its pages as he walked. A scowl suddenly crossed his face as his skin turned beet red. Santa Maria, he hissed. He tore out the record right in front of me. There was a hand-drawn map of the mine location right there. Now it's gone. The old man slammed the book to the counter while turning an angry eye toward the door. Pitt could see where two pages had been neatly torn from the journal. I'd venture to say that your Mr. Booth isn't who he said he was, Pitt said. I should have suspected something when he didn't know what a sluice box was, the man grumbled. I don't know why he had to deface our records. He could have just asked for a copy. Pitt knew the reason why. Mr. Booth didn't want anyone else to know the source of the Inuit ruthenium. He slid the journal around and read a partial entry ahead of the missing pages. October 22, 1917. Horace Tucker of the Churchill Trading Company consigned following unrefined ore quantities. 5 tons of copper ore, 12 tons of lead ore, 2 tons of zinc, 1/4 ton of ruthenium. Adelaide, Black Kabluna. Source and assayer comments to follow. That was the only Inuit shipment you've received? Pitt asked. The old man nodded. That was it. The missing pages indicated that the mineral had actually been obtained decades earlier. That trading post in Churchill couldn't find a market for the stuff until Tucker brought a sample in with some minerals from a mine in Manitoba. Any chance the Churchill Trading Company records still exist? Pretty doubtful. They went out of business back around 1960. I met Tucker a few years later in Winnipeg shortly before he died. I remember him telling me how the old log trading post in Churchill had burned to the ground. I would imagine their trading records were destroyed in the fire. I guess that's the end of the line, then. I'm sorry about the theft of your data, but thank you for sharing what you know. Hold on a second, the man replied. He stepped over and opened the thick door to the ancient safe. He rummaged around a wooden bin inside, then turned and tossed something to Pitt. It was a tiny, smooth stone, silvery white in color. Black Kabluna? He asked. A sample on the house, so that you know what we've been talking about. Pitt reached across the counter and shook hands with the geologist, thanking him for his time. One more thing, the old man said as Pitt strolled toward the door. You run into that Booth fella. You be sure and tell him I'm coming after him with a pickaxe if I ever see him again. The afternoon had turned colder under the cast of an approaching front, and Pitt waited anxiously for the car heater to warm up as he exited the co-op's parking lot. Grabbing a quick lunch at a cafe in Blind River, he drove back through the winding mountain road toward the airport, contemplating the Inuit ruthenium tale. The ore had to have come from the Arctic, presumably near the Inuit camp at Adelaide. How had the Inuit, with primitive technology, mined the ruthenium? Were there still significant reserves in place? And who was John Booth, and why was he interested in the Inuit ore? The questions brought no answers as he wound through the scenic hills, braking as he pulled up behind a slower-moving RV. Reaching a straight stretch in the road, the RV driver pulled to the shoulder and waved for Pitt to pass. Pitt stomped on the accelerator and sped past the motorhome, which he noted had a Colorado license plate. The road snaked sharply ahead of him, the two lanes carving into the edge of a rocky mountainside that tumbled down to a river below. Twisting through a tight bend, Pitt could see the roadway a mile ahead, where the highway nearly doubled back on a parallel facing. Parked in a turnout, he caught glimpse of a white sedan. It was the same vehicle that John Booth had climbed into at the co-op. Pitt lost sight of the car as the roadway bended and twisted once more. Rounding through a tight S-curve, the road straightened again for a short stretch. To Pitt's left, the hillside plunged in a steep drop-off, falling several hundred feet to the river below. As his rental car gained speed on the straightaway, Pitt heard a faint pop, like the burst of a distant 4th of July firework. He glanced ahead but noticed nothing, as a deep rumble followed the initial noise. A movement caught his eye and he looked up to see a house-sized boulder sliding down the mountainside above him. The huge rock was falling in a perfect trajectory to intersect with Pitt's car 200 feet down the road. Pitt instantly stomped on the brakes, mashing the pedal to the floorboard. The tires chirped and shimmied in protest, but the car's anti-lock braking system kept the vehicle from skidding uncontrollably. In the brief seconds Pitt waited for the car to stop, he observed that a full landslide was now underway. In addition to the huge rock, a whole wall of rocks and gravel was chasing the boulder down the mountainside. With seemingly half of the mountain barreling toward him, he knew he would have only one chance to escape. His quick braking slowed the car just enough to prevent him from being flattened by the first mammoth boulder. The huge rock hit the asphalt just 20 feet in front of him, splintering into several smaller sections. Most of the rock pieces continued their downhill slide, smashing through the guardrail and tumbling down the steep precipice toward the river. A few large chunks died on the road, soon to be buried by the impeding landslide that followed. Pitt's car skidded into one of the chunks, a flattened slab of granite that instantly stopped his momentum. Though mashing the bumper and grill, the car's mechanics were undamaged. Inside, Pitt only felt a strong jolt, but it was enough to inflate the airbag, which ballooned in front of his chest as the vehicle bounced backward. Pitt's quick senses had beaten the airbag, though. He had already jammed the automatic transmission into reverse and stomped on the accelerator at the moment of impact. The rear tires smoked as they spun wildly before gripping the pavement and propelling the car backward. Pitt gripped the steering wheel and held it steady as the car tried to fishtail from the sudden rearward torque before settling on a stable line. The transmission screamed beneath Pitt's feet as the low-ratio reverse gear fought to maintain revolutions with the floored engine. Pitt glanced up the hill to see the sliding mass of rocks and gravel already descending upon him. The landslide had spread across a wide lane, extending well to his rear. He quickly realized there was no way he could outrun it. Like a slate-colored tidal wave, the sliding wall of rock cascaded onto the roadway, spilling first a few yards in front of him. For an instant, it appeared as if the speeding car might slip past the deluge, but then a separate cluster of boulders broke free and crashed to the road behind him. Pitt could do nothing but hold on as the car barreled into the moving layer of rocks with a screeching peal of twisted metal. The car scraped over a large boulder, snapping off the rear axle and sending one of the drive wheels careening down the hill. Pitt was thrown back into his seat as a secondary wall of falling rocks smashed into the passenger side, lifting the car up and over onto its roof. Pitt was flung to his left, his head striking a side airbag as it inflated. Seconds later, he was jarred to the side again, his head banging through the deflating airbag until striking the driver's side window. A great battering roar filled his ears as the car was pummeled across the road, slamming hard to a sudden stop. Inside, Pitt teetered on the brink of consciousness as the sound of rushing gravel surrounded him. His vision went blurry as he was buffeted in his seat. He vaguely felt a warm wetness to his face, and then all feeling vanished as he dropped into a silent void of blackness. Chapter 38 Pitt knew that he was alive from the jackhammer-like pounding that racked his skull. His auditory senses kicked in next, detecting a rhythmic scraping sound nearby. He wriggled his fingers, finding a heavy resistance but confirming that they were still wrapped around the steering wheel of the rental car. Though his legs moved freely, his head, chest, and arms felt completely restricted. The realization that he couldn't breathe suddenly struck his foggy mind, and he struggled to free himself, but he felt like a bound mummy. He slowly pried open the lids of his eyes, which felt as if they had been glued shut, but all he saw was black. The grip on his lungs grew tighter, and he thrashed harder, finally freeing a hand and forearm from their mysterious hold. He heard a voice and a frantic scuffling sound, then a scraping sensation skinned his face as a burst of light blinded his eyes. He sucked in a breath of dusty air, then squinted through a thick surrounding haze. Staring back at him was a pair of affectionate brown eyes, affixed to the tiny head of a black-and-tan dachshund. Most confusing to Pitt, the dog appeared to be standing upside down. The dog inched closer, sniffing Pitt's exposed face before licking him on the nose. "Out of the way, Mauser, he's still alive," came a man's voice from nearby. A pair of thick hands appeared and scooped away more of the dirt and gravel that had buried Pitt's head and torso. Pitt's arms finally broke free, and he helped push the small mountain of dirt away from his body. Reaching up with his sleeve, he wiped away the matted blood and dust from his eyes and finally took a look at his surroundings. With the seatbelt tugging uncomfortably across his chest, he finally realized that he was the one upside down, not the dachshund. The helping pair of hands reached in and found the release button on the seatbelt, dropping Pitt to the ceiling of the car. Pitt shuffled toward the driver's side window, but the hands yanked him toward the open passenger door. "You don't want to go that way, mister. The first step is a doozy." Pitt heeded the voice and crawled toward the passenger door, where he was helped out and onto his feet. The pounding in his head eased as he stood upright, but a light trickle of blood still rolled down his cheek. Looking at the damaged car, he shook his head at the good fortune that had saved him. The sliding mass of rock and gravel that had battered the car and flipped it on its roof had also pushed it across the road to the very edge of the steep chasm that fell to the river below. The car would have easily gone over the edge, taking Pitt to his death, but for a firmly cemented mileage signpost. The slim metal post caught the car just behind the front fender, pinning it to the edge of the road as tons of loose rock plunged down the hill around both ends of the car. The road itself was buried under a mound of dirt and rocks for a stretch of 50 yards. "Must be some clean living that kept you from going over the edge," Pitt heard his rescuer say. He turned to face a robust older man with white hair and beard who stood gazing at Pitt through a pair of jovial gray eyes. "It wasn't clean living that saved me, I can assure you," Pitt replied. "Thank you for pulling me out. I would have suffocated in there if you hadn't dug your way in." "Don't mention it. Why don't you come on back to the RV and let me patch you up," the man said, pointing to a motorhome parked on unblemished asphalt a few yards away. It was the same motorhome that Pitt had passed earlier on the road. Pitt nodded and followed the man and the little black-and-tan dachshund as they climbed into an open side door of the RV. Pitt was surprised to find the interior finished in teak and polished brass, which gave the look of a luxury cabin on a sailing ship. On one wall, he noticed, curiously, a bookcase filled with reference guides to mining and geology. "Why don't you get yourself cleaned up while I find my medical kit?" the man said. Pitt washed his hands and face in a porcelain sink as a Royal Canadian Mounted Police car raced up with its lights flashing. The old man stepped out and spoke to the police, then returned a few minutes later and helped Pitt apply a bandage to a thin gash that zigzagged across the left side of his scalp. "The Mounties said there's a highway construction crew working just a few miles away. They can get a front-end loader over here pretty quick and should have a lane cleared through the rocks in just an hour or two. They'll want to take a report from you when you feel up to it." "Thanks for putting them off. I'm just starting to get my bearings back. Forgive me for not asking earlier. You must surely need a drink. What can I get you?" "I'd kill for a tequila if you have any," Pitt replied, sagging into a small leather-upholstered chair. The dachshund immediately jumped into his lap and coaxed Pitt to pet him behind the ears. "You are in luck," the man replied, pulling a stubby bottle of Don Julio tequila out of a cabinet. Swirling the bottle around, he said, "Still a few shots left." "I'm lucky twice today." "That's a fine brand of tequila," Pitt remarked, recognizing the expensive label of blue agave cactus juice. "Mauser and I like to travel well," the man said with a grin as he poured two healthy shots for Pitt and himself. Pitt let the warm liquid trickle down his throat, admiring its complex flavor. He felt his head clear almost immediately. "That was quite a slide," the man said. "Good thing you weren't a few yards farther down the road." "I saw it coming and tried to back away from it, but came up a little short." "I don't know what kind of fool would be blasting above an open highway," he said, "but I sure hope they catch the bugger." "Blasting?" Pitt asked, suddenly recalling the white sedan he saw parked up the road. "I heard the pop and noticed a puff of white smoke up the hill right before those boulders started dancing. I told the Mounties about it, but they said there are no blasting crews working anywhere around here." "You don't think it was just a large boulder that let go and kicked up the rest?" The man knelt down and opened a wide drawer beneath the bookshelf. Digging beneath a thick blanket, he exposed a small wooden box marked Dino Nobel. Pitt recognized the manufacturer's name as the offshoot of Alfred Nobel, inventor of dynamite. Opening the lid, the man showed Pitt a number of 8-inch-long yellow cartridges packed inside. "I do a little blasting myself now and then when investigating a potential mineral vein." "You're a prospector?" Pitt asked, nodding toward the shelf of geology books. "More of a hobby than a profession," the man replied. "I just like searching for things of value. I would never be blasting near civilization, but that's probably what happened here. Some fool found something shiny up the hill and decided he had to have a closer look. I wouldn't want to foot his cleanup bill if he gets caught." Pitt nodded silently, suspecting that the blast hadn't originated from an innocent miner. "What brings you to this area?" Pitt asked. "Silver," the prospector replied, holding up the tequila bottle and pouring Pitt a second shot. "There used to be a working silver mine up near Algoma Mills before everyone went crazy around here for uranium. I figure if they had one big strike in the area, there's bound to be a few scraps around for a small-timer like me." He shook his head, then grinned. "So far, my theory hasn't panned out." Pitt smiled, then downed the glass of tequila. He turned to the prospector and asked, "What do you know about the mineral ruthenium?" The prospector rubbed his chin for a moment. "Well, it's a relative of platinum, though not associated with deposits in these parts. I know the price has skyrocketed, so there's probably a lot more folks out searching for the stuff, but I've never run across any. Can't say that I know anybody else who has either. As I recall, there are only a few places in the world where they mine it. My only other recollection about ruthenium is that some folks thought it had something to do with the old Pretoria lunatic mill." "I'm not familiar with the story," Pitt replied. "An old miner's tale out of South Africa. I read about it while doing some research on diamonds. Apparently there was a small weaving mill built near the turn of the century near Pretoria, South Africa. After operating for about a year, they started finding the mill workers going batty. It got so bad they had to close down the factory. The lunacy probably had something to do with the chemicals they used, but it never was clearly identified. It was later noted that the plant was built next to a platinum mine rich with ruthenium, and that ruthenium ore, which had little value back then, was stockpiled in great mounds next to the mill. At least one historian thought that the unusual mineral had something to do with crazy behavior." "It's an interesting story," Pitt replied, recalling his discussion at the co-op. "Have you by chance heard of any mining done by the Inuit up north in the old days?" "Can't say that I have. Of course, the Arctic is considered a mining candyland these days. Diamonds in the Northwest Territories, coal on Ellesmere Island, and of course oil and natural gas prospects all over the place." They were interrupted by a granite-faced Mountie, who poked his head in the door and asked Pitt to fill out a police report on his damaged rental car. The road construction crew arrived shortly after and went to work clearing a path through the debris. The loose rock and gravel was quickly pushed aside, and it was only a short while before a single lane of traffic was opened through the landslide area. "Any chance I could bum a ride with you to the Elliott Lake Airport?" Pitt asked the old prospector. "I'm headed to the Sudbury region, so you're pretty much on my way." "Grab a seat up front," he replied, taking a seat behind the wheel. The big RV barely squeezed through the debris before finding open road on the far side of the landslide. The two men chatted about history and mining until the motorhome pulled to a stop outside the tiny airport terminal. "There you go, Mr. Pitt, Dirk Pitt. My name's Clive Cussler. Happy trails to you, Mr. Pitt." Pitt shook the old prospector's hand, then gave the dachshund a pat on the head before climbing out of the RV. "I'm obliged to you for your help," Pitt said, looking at the prospector with a familiar sense of kinship. "Good luck in finding that beckoning motherlode." Pitt walked into the building and approached the terminal manager, whose mouth gaped when he turned his way. Pitt looked like he had just been run over by a Greyhound bus. His hair and clothes were caked in dust, while a bloodied bandage crossed his scalp. When Pitt relayed how the rental car was sitting on the highway upside down and filled with rocks, the manager nearly went into convulsions. While filling out an endless stack of insurance papers, Pitt glanced out the window and noticed the Gulfstream jet was no longer parked on the tarmac. "How long ago did our fellow jet depart?" he asked the manager. "Oh, about an hour or two ago. His stay wasn't much longer than yours. I think I saw him in town. Kind of a burly guy in a brown suit?" "Yes, that was the customer." "Mind if I ask where he was headed?" "You two are both nosy. He asked who you were," he said, picking up a clipboard and running his finger down a short list of aircraft arrivals and departures. Pitt casually leaned over the manager's shoulder, catching the plane's tail number, CFTGI, which he committed to memory. "While I can't tell you who was aboard, I can tell you that the plane is bound for Vancouver with a scheduled fuel stop in Regina, Saskatchewan." "They visit Elliott Lake often?" "No, I can't say I've seen that plane here before." The manager tilted his head toward a small room in the corner of the terminal. "Why don't you grab a cup of coffee in the lounge and I'll notify your flight crew that you're here?" Pitt agreed and made his way to the lounge, where he poured a cup of coffee from a stained-glass pot. A corner-mounted television was tuned to a Calgary rodeo, but Pitt stared past the Bronco riders, toying with the scattered puzzle pieces of the last few days. His trip to the miners' co-op had been made on a lark, yet his hunch had been right. Sourcing a supply of ruthenium was of global importance, and somebody else was in on the hunt. He thought back to the well-dressed man in the white sedan, John Booth. There was something familiar about the man, but Pitt knew no one in Vancouver that had the means to fly in a corporate jet. The terminal manager popped into the lounge, refilling a large coffee cup as he spoke to Pitt. "Your flight crew is on their way to your aircraft. I told them you would be right out." As he spoke, he ripped open a packet of sugar to pour into his coffee. The bag ripped completely in half, though, showering the carpeted floor in white granules. "Jeez," he groaned, tossing the empty packet aside. "Well, that will give the night janitor something to do," he muttered, staring at the mess. Pitt was likewise staring at the mess, but with a different reaction. His eyes suddenly turned bright, and a sly grin spread across his lips. "A fortuitous disaster," he said to the manager, who looked back at him blankly. "Thanks for your assistance. I need to make a couple of phone calls, then I'll be right aboard." When he crossed the tarmac a few minutes later, Pitt had a spry step to his aching bones, and the gash to his head had ceased hurting. Across his face, the sly grin was still firmly embedded in place. Chapter 39.
"Minister Jameson, I have Mitchell Goyette on line one," the gray-haired secretary said, poking her head into Jameson's office like a gopher. Jameson nodded from his desk, then waited until his secretary closed the door on her way out before hesitantly picking up the phone.
"Arthur, how are things in our lovely capital city?" Goyette greeted with mock friendship.
"Ottawa is enjoying a warm spring to accompany the hot jingoistic climate in Parliament."
"It's high time we retain Canada's resources for Canadians," Goyette snorted.
"Yes, so that we can sell them to the Chinese," the minister replied dryly.
Goyette promptly turned serious. "There's a small pile of rocks in the Arctic southeast of Victoria Island called the Royal Geographical Society Islands. I'll be needing the mineral rights to the entire landmass," he said, as if asking for a cup of coffee.
"Let me take a look," Jameson replied, pulling a bundle of maps from his desk drawer. Finding a map marked Victoria Strait, which was overlaid with numbered grid lines, he moved to a desktop computer. Inputting the grid numbers, he accessed the ministry's records of exploration and extraction licenses issued by the government. Within a few minutes, he had an answer for Goyette.
"I'm afraid we already have a production license in place, which covers about 30% of the islands, primarily the southern portion of West Island. It's a 10-year license, but they are only entering their second year of operations. The license is held by Kingfisher Holdings, a subsidiary of the Mid-America Mining Company out of Butte, Montana. They have built a small mining facility and are currently extracting small quantities of zinc, apparently just in the summer months."
"An American firm holds the license?"
"Yes, but through a Canadian shell company. There's technically no law against it, providing they post the required security bond and meet the other provisions of the license agreement."
"I want the license rescinded and reissued to one of my entities," Goyette said matter-of-factly.
Jameson shook his head at Goyette's presumption.
"There would have to be a violation of the license, such as environmental polluting or shortchanging the royalty payments. It can't be done unilaterally, Mitchell, without setting the government up for a major lawsuit."
"Then how do I obtain the rights?" he huffed.
"Mid-America is currently in compliance, according to the latest inspection report, so your only option would be to try and purchase the rights directly from them. They would no doubt gouge you for the pleasure."
He thought for a moment.
"There may, in fact, be another possibility."
"Go ahead," Goyette urged impatiently.
"There is a national defense clause in the license. Should this brouhaha with the United States continue to escalate, there is a possibility of using it for grounds to terminate the license. The clause allows for the termination of foreign-held licenses in the event of war, conflict, or dissolution of state relations. A long shot, of course, but one never knows. What exactly is your interest in the islands?
Something that is as good as gold, Goyette replied quietly.
Regaining his brashness, he barked, Prepare the necessary details for me to bid on a new license. I'll figure out a way to have this Mid-America Corporation cough it up.
Very well, Jameson replied, his teeth gritted. I will await your results.
That's not all. As you know, the Melville Sound site is showing extraordinarily rich reserves of natural gas, yet I only own rights to a tiny fraction of the fields. I will be needing to obtain the extraction rights to the entire region.
The line fell silent for several seconds before Jameson finally muttered, I'm not sure that will be possible.
Nothing is impossible for the right price, Goyette laughed. You'll find that most of the tracts are previously ice-covered regions that nobody was interested in. Until now.
That is the problem.
Word is out that major shipments are already being made from Melville. We're receiving dozens of exploration requests for the area.
Well, don't bother responding to them. The Melville gas fields will be worth billions, and I'm not going to let them slip through my fingers, he snapped.
I will be sending you several maps shortly. They delineate my desired exploration zones, which encompass large sections of Melville Sound and some other Arctic regions. I intend to dramatically expand my exploration business in the Arctic and want wholesale exploration licenses for the entire lot. There are incredible profits available there, and you'll be aptly rewarded, so don't blow it. Goodbye, Arthur.
Jameson heard a click as the line went dead. The resources minister sat frozen for a moment until a seething anger welled up from within. Then he slammed the phone down with a whack.
2,000 miles to the west, Goyette punched off his speakerphone and leaned back in his chair. Gazing across his office desk, he stared into the cool eyes of Clay Zack.
Nothing ever comes easy, he griped.
Now tell me again why this ruthenium is so bloody important.
It's quite simple, Zack replied.
If you can monopolize the supply of ruthenium, then you can control a primary solution to global warming. What you elect to do with the mineral is a matter of money. And ego, I suppose.
I'm listening, Goyette grunted.
Assuming that you control the principal supply, then you have a choice to make. Mitchell Goyette, the environmentalist, can become the savior of the planet and pocket a few bucks along the way, fueling the expansion of artificial photosynthesis factories around the world.
But there is a risk on the demand side, Goyette argued. We really don't know how much ruthenium will ultimately be needed, so the profits could be enormous or they could be squat.
I've staked most of my worth in developing control of the Northwest Passage. I have invested heavily in natural gas and oil sands infrastructure to be able to ship through the passage, supported by my fleet of Arctic vessels. I have long-term export agreements in place with the Chinese and will soon have the Americans pleading on their knees. And I've got a potential booming business in carbon dioxide sequestration. If global warming is reversed or even halted, I could face extended ice issues that run counter to my entire business strategy.
In that case, I suppose we can turn to Mitchell Goyette, the unrepentant capitalist, who can recognize a profit opportunity blindfolded and will stop at nothing to keep his financial empire expanding.
You flatter me, Goyette replied sarcastically. But you have made the decision easy. I can't afford to have the Northwest Passage revert to a solid chunk of ice. The recent melting is what has allowed me to gain control of the Melville Sound gas fields and monopolize transportation in the region. Maybe 10 or 15 years from now, when the oil sands and gas reserves are nearing depletion, I can go save the planet. By then, the ruthenium may even be exponentially more valuable. Spoken like a true capitalist. Goyette reached over and picked up 2 thin pages of paper lying on his desk. They were the journal entries Zack had stolen from the miners' co-op. The basis for this whole ruthenium claim still seems rather flimsy, he said, examining the pages. A trader purchased the ore in 1917 from an Inuit whose grandfather acquired the stuff some 70 years earlier. The grandfather was from Adelaide, but claimed the ruthenium came from the Royal Geographical Society Islands. On top of that, he called it Black Kobluna and said the source was cursed with dark spirits. Hardly the basis of a scientific mining claim. He peered at Zack, unsure whether the whole thing might be a ruse on the part of the paid assassin. Zack stared back without blinking. It may be a long shot, but the Inuit ruthenium had to come from somewhere, and we're talking 160 years ago in the middle of the Arctic. The journal has a map of the island showing exactly where it was mined. The Inuit didn't have front-end loaders and dump trucks back then, so they would have had to pretty much find the stuff lying on the ground. There has to be more there. While this Mid-America company has appeared in the area, they're looking for zinc, and on the opposite side of the island. Yes, Mitchell, it may well be a long shot. But there could be an enormous payoff if it's there, and an enormous cost to you if someone else gets to it first. Aren't we the only ones who know about the Inuit deposits? Zack squinted slightly, his lips pressed in a tight grimace. There is the possibility that Dirk Pitt is aware of the trail, he said. Pitt? Goyette asked, shaking his head in non-recognition. He's the director of the National Underwater and Marine Agency in the United States. I ran into him at the research lab in Washington and noticed him giving aid to the lab manager after the explosion. He appeared again in Ontario at the miners' co-op just after I took these journal entries. I tried to arrange an accident on the road out of town, but some old man helped him escape. He's obviously aware of the importance of ruthenium in triggering the artificial photosynthesis process. He might be on to you as well, Goyette said, a troubling crease crossing his brow. I can take care of that easily enough, Zack said. It's not a good idea to be blowing up high-visibility government officials. He can't do anything from the States. I'll have him tailed just to make sure he stays there. Besides, I'll need you to go to the Arctic and investigate the Royal Geographical Society Islands. Take a security team with you, and I'll send along some of my top geologists. Then figure out a way to put Mid-America out of business. I want you to find the ruthenium. Obtain it at any cost. All of it. That's the Mitchell Goyette I know and love, Zack said with a twisted smile. We haven't talked about my share. It's a pipe dream at the moment. 10% of the royalties is more than generous. I was thinking of 50%. That's absurd. I'll be incurring all of the capital costs. 15%. It's going to take 20. Goyette clenched his teeth. Get off my boat and enjoy the cold. Chapter 40. Despite Lauren's pleas to stay in bed and rest, Pitt rose early the next morning and dressed for work. His body ached worse than it had the day before, and he moved slowly until his joints gradually limbered up. He contemplated drinking a tequila with orange juice to deaden the pain, but finally thought better of it. The aches of injury took longer to vanquish, he thought, cursing the mark of time and its toll on his body. Lauren summoned him to the bathroom, where she cleaned the scrape on his head and applied a fresh bandage. "At least your hair will cover that one up," she said, scraping her finger across several scars on Pitt's chest and back. Numerous bouts with death in the past had left their share of physical marks, as well as a few mental ones. A lucky blow to the head, he quipped. Maybe it will knock some sense into you, she replied, wrapping her arms around his torso. While Pitt had told Lauren of the events in Ontario, he had neglected to mention that the landslide had not occurred by accident. She reached up and lightly kissed his scalp, then reminded him that he had promised to take her to lunch later in the day. I'll pick you up at noon, he promised. He reached his office by 8 o'clock and sat through a pair of research briefings before phoning Don Martin later in the morning. The FBI director sounded excited to hear from Pitt. Dirk, your tip yesterday was a good one. You were correct. The janitorial service at the George Washington University lab works in the evenings. We reviewed the lab security video and found a clean shot of your wayward morning janitor. He fit your description to a T. Sitting in the airport lounge in Elliott Lake, Pitt had finally made the connection between the man at the co-op and the janitor he had bumped into at the lab just prior to the explosion. Have you been able to identify him? Pitt asked. After confirming that he was not part of the building maintenance and janitorial staff, we ran his photo through the Homeland Security Identification Database. Not an exact science, mind you, but we came up with a potential hit list and one pretty good match in particular. On this side of the border, he goes by Robert Ford of Buffalo, New York. We've already confirmed that the registered address is a fake, as well as the name. Pitt repeated the name Robert Ford, then thought of the alias he had used in Blind River, John Booth. Too coincidental, Pitt thought. John Wilkes Booth was the man who had shot Lincoln, while Robert Ford had killed Jesse James. He has an admiration for historical assassins, Pitt offered. Might be his line of work. We crossed our records with the Canadian authorities, and they think they have him pegged as a fellow named Clay Zack. Are they going to pick him up? They would if they knew where to find him. He's a wanted suspect in a 20-year-old murder at a Canadian nickel mine. His whereabouts have been unknown ever since. A nickel mine? Might be a tie to his use of dynamite. We're following that up now. The Canadians might not find him, but if he sets foot in the country again, we'll have a good chance at picking him up. Nice work, Dan. You've accomplished a lot in short order. A lucky break that you recalled your encounter. There's one more thing that you might be interested in knowing. Lisa Lane's lab assistant, Bob Hamilton. We were able to obtain a search warrant on the guy's financial institution records. It seems that he just had $50,000 wired into his bank account from an offshore entity. I suspected something was amiss with that one. We will do a little more digging, then bring him in for questioning at the end of the week. We'll see if there is a connection, but I have to say, things look promising at the moment. I'm glad the investigation has legs. Thanks for your efforts. Thank you, Dirk. You've given us a nice jump on the case. Pitt wondered how his own research was going and took the stairwell down to the 10th-floor computer operations center. He found Yeager seated at his console conversing again with Max, who stood before a large projection screen. A flattened map of the globe was displayed, with dozens of pinpoint lights flashing from scattered points across the oceans. Each light represented a buoy that relayed sea and weather info via satellite link to the headquarters building. Problem with the sea buoy system? Pitt asked, taking a seat beside Yeager. We've had an uplink problem with a number of segments, Yeager replied. I'm having Max run some software tests to try and isolate the problem. If the latest software release had been properly tested before going operational, we wouldn't be incurring this problem, Max injected. Turning to Pitt, she said good morning, then eyed Pitt's bandage. What happened to your head? I got in a slight fender bender on a rocky road, he replied. We've tracked the information on the jet tail number that you phoned in about, Yeager said. It can wait. Fixing the sea buoy data is more important. I can multitask with the best of them, Max offered with a touch of indignation. She's running a test that will take 20 minutes, Yeager explained. We can exercise her until the results come back. Turning to the holograph image, he said, Max, Bring up the data on the Canadian Gulfstream jet. The aircraft is a brand new Gulfstream G650 18-passenger jet, manufactured in 2009. According to Canadian aeronautical records, the tail number CFTGI is registered to Terra Green Industries of Vancouver, British Columbia. Terra Green is a privately held company chaired by a man named Mitchell Goyette. Hence the TGI in the tail number, Yeager said. At least he didn't flaunt his personal initials, like most filthy rich jet owners. Goyette, Pitt mused. Isn't he big into green energy? His holdings include wind farms, geothermal and hydroelectric power plants, and a small number of solar panel fields, Max recited. Being privately held tends to obscure things, Yeager said, so we did a little digging. Found over 24 other entities that trace their ownership to Terra Green. Turns out a number of the holdings were related to gas, oil, and mining exploration activities, particularly in the Athabasca region of Alberta. So Terra Green is apparently not all that green, Pitt quipped. It's worse than that. Another Terra Green subsidiary apparently controls a recently discovered natural gas field in the Melville Sound. Its value could conceivably outweigh his other holdings combined. We also found an interesting nautical link to NUMA. It seems that over the past few years, Terra Green has contracted for the construction of several big icebreakers from a Mississippi Gulf shipyard, along with a number of very large LNG and bulk carrier barges. It was the same yard that built our last research ship, which was delayed in launching due in part to their work for Terra Green. Yes, the Loudoun Shipyard in New Orleans, Pitt recalled. I saw one of those barges in dry dock. It was a massive thing. I wonder what they're transporting. I have not attempted to locate the vessels, but I can try if you like, Max said. Pitt shook his head. Probably not important. Max, can you determine if Terra Green is conducting any research related to artificial photosynthesis or other countermeasures to greenhouse gas emissions? Max stood motionless as she scanned her databases for published research reports and news releases. I find no references to Terra Green and artificial photosynthesis. They operate a small research facility devoted to solar research and have published work in carbon sequestration. The company has, in fact, just opened a carbon sequestration facility in Kitimat, British Columbia. The company is known to be in discussions with the Canadian government to build an unknown number of additional sequestration facilities across the country. Kitimat? I just received an email from Summer, who was riding from there, Yeager said. Yes, the kids apparently stopped there for a few days on their way down the inside passage, testing the local sea alkalinity, Pitt said. Do you think the carbon sequestration plants figure in as a motive to halt Lisa Lane's research? Yeager asked. I can't say, but it could be a possibility. It's clear that Goyette is after the ruthenium. He explained his visit to the miners' co-op and the chance encounter with the man he'd seen at the GWU lab. He recited the portions of the journal entry he had read and pulled out his notes for Yeager. Max, last time we talked, you indicated that there was little, if any, mining of ruthenium taking place, he said. That's correct. Just a small quantity of low-grade ore being produced from a mine in Bolivia. The mining co-op has a finite inventory left. Do you have any data on potential deposits in the Arctic? Max stood motionless for a moment, then shook her head. No, sir. I find no mention in any recorded surveys or mining claims that I have access to, which mostly date from the 1960s. Pitt eyed his journal notes, then said, I have a record from 1917 that a quantity of ruthenium called Black Kobluna was obtained some 68 years earlier by a number of Adelaide Peninsula Inuit. Does that mean anything to you, Max? I'm sorry, sir. I still don't find any relevant mining references, she replied, a hurt look in her transparent eyes. She never calls me, sir, Jaeger muttered quietly. Max ignored Jaeger as she tried to generate an added response to Pitt. The Adelaide Peninsula is located on the north coast of Nunavut, just to the south of King William Island. The peninsula is considered an essentially uninhabited landmass, historically occupied at certain seasons by small groups of migrating Inuit. Max, what is meant by the term black kabluna? Jaeger asked. Max hesitated while accessing a linguistics database at Stanford University. She then tipped her head at Jaeger and Pitt with a confused look on her face. It is a contradictory phrase, she said. Please explain, requested Jaeger. Kabluna is an Inuit term for white man. Hence, it is a mixed translation of black white man. Contradictory indeed, Jaeger said. Perhaps it means a white man dressed in black or vice versa. Possibly, Pitt said. But that was a remote section of the Arctic. I'm not sure a white or black man had even set foot there by that point in time. Isn't that true, Max?
You are nearly correct. Initial exploration and mapping of the Canadian Arctic came in a British-inspired quest for a northwest passage to the Pacific Ocean. A large portion of the western and eastern regions of the Canadian Arctic had been well charted by the mid-19th century. The middle regions, including a number of passages around Adelaide Peninsula, were, in fact, some of the last areas charted. Pitt glanced at his notes from the miners' co-op.
The record indicates that the Inuit recovered the ruthenium in or around 1849.
The historical record shows an expedition under the guise of the Hudson's Bay Company surveyed a region of North American coastline in the vicinity between 1837 and 1839.
That's a little too early, Jaeger remarked.
The next known forays were made by John Ray in 1851 during his search for survivors of the Franklin expedition. He was known to have traveled along the southeast coast of Victoria Island, which is still approximately 100 miles from the Adelaide Peninsula. It was not until 1859 that the area was reached again, this time by Francis McClintock, who visited nearby King William Island, just north of Adelaide, during another search for Franklin.
That's a little late in the game, said Jaeger.
But there's Franklin, Pitt said, searching his memory.
When did he sail into those waters, and where was he lost?
The Franklin expedition sailed from England in 1845. They wintered the first year at Beachy Island, then traveled south until becoming trapped in the ice off King William Island. The expedition ships were abandoned in the spring of 1848, with the entire crew later dying on shore sometime later.
Pitt mulled the dates in his head, then thanked Max for the information. The holographic woman nodded and turned aside, resuming her software test calculations. If Franklin's men left their ships in 1848 well north of the peninsula, it doesn't figure they would be lugging some minerals around with them, remarked Jaeger.
It's possible that the Inuit erred in the date, Pitt replied. The other point to consider is Max's comment about the Adelaide Peninsula being an Inuit migration stop. Just because the Inuit were known to camp on the peninsula doesn't mean that is where they acquired the mineral.
Good point. Do you think there's a connection with the Franklin expedition?
Pitt nodded slowly.
Might be our only real link, he said. But you heard what Max said. The entire crew perished. That would seem to eliminate any hope of finding an answer there.
There's always hope, Pitt said, with a glint to his eye. He looked at his watch, then rose to leave.
As a matter of fact, Hiram, I fully expect to be on the right path just this afternoon.
Chapter 41
Pitt borrowed an agency jeep and picked up Lauren on Capitol Hill, then drove across downtown D.C.
You have time for a long lunch? He asked, sitting at a stoplight.
You're in luck. I have no hearings scheduled for today. I'm just reviewing some draft legislation. What did you have in mind?
A side trip to Georgetown.
To my condo? For a little afternoon delight? She asked coyly. A tempting proposition, he replied, squeezing her hand, but I'm afraid we have a lunch reservation that can't be cancelled. The noontime traffic clogged the streets until Pitt maneuvered onto M Street, which led to the heart of Georgetown. How's Lisa coming along? He asked. She's being released from the hospital today and is anxious to get back to work. I'm arranging a briefing with the White House office on science and technology once she has the chance to document and summarize her findings. That might take a few weeks, though. Lisa called me this morning a little upset. Her lab assistant has apparently taken another position out of state. Just quit on her without notice. Bob Hamilton. Yes, that's his name. The one you don't trust. He's supposed to talk to the FBI later this week. Something tells me he won't be leaving for that new job anytime soon.